This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Mannix and Beck, Crossover NBA podcast. What up, Beck?
What's happening, Mannix?
Well, you know, I'm just wondering, have you been fined $50,000 today for any of your tweets?
No, but it's early yet, and I'm saving my best tweets for later. So the possibility is always there. Of course, we gotta scale it down. We gotta make it proportional. Like, what is $50,000 to Daryl Morey? Is that $5 to you and me? Is it a latte?
Like the $50,000 is $50,000. Like, no matter how much money you make, $50,000 is not something you sniff at. I mean, can we talk about that for a second? Because, like, that to me, I don't know how you viewed that fine. But look, for context here, Daryl, you know, his Twitter account automatically retweeted a congratulatory post for James Harden's performance a year ago today. It was from this, you know, this Twitter app. What is this? On This Date dot whatever. And it was sent out, and Daryl didn't do it intentionally, I'm sure. But the NBA came down and slapped him with a $50,000 fine. Howard, this to me was the NBA's way of fining Daryl Morey for his Hong Kong tweet. Like, this, they couldn't fine him for that because it's a bad look. But this is them fining him for the Hong Kong tweet. Is there any way that could be true?
We need a pie chart for this one. Like, maybe some percentage of it is Hong Kong and that tweet. Maybe some percentage of it is just because he's Daryl and he irritates people sometimes. Maybe it's all the memos he's sending to the league office, you know, about officiating in the 2018 conference finals or whatever it was. Who knows? It could be a lot of things that they are that. And listen, in all seriousness, I think the fine, I could both totally justify it, Chris, and I could completely toss it aside as being ridiculous. The justifiable part is this: the league went to all this trouble a year and a half ago, whenever it was, that they rolled out all these new anti-tampering measures. We're going to crack down. We're going to finally rein this thing in. We understand it's gotten out of control. And it's been years that people have been saying, listen, tampering is just running totally rampant and unchecked, and it's the Wild West. So the league finally did something. And so every time now there's something that is, I would say, the low-hanging fruit, they're gonna nail somebody. So the Bucks on Bogdan Bogdanovich, they're gonna dock him a second round pick because that was a layup among rules infractions. Are there much bigger issues of and examples of tampering that they just can't prove? Hell yes, there are. And in this case, Chris, Daryl's tweet, let's even say it was intentional. Let's say he was getting too cute. Let's say it was not a scheduled automatic thing from this Twitter app.
Which neither one of us believe, by the way. We both believe it was unintentional, correct?
I think it was probably unintentional. Unintentional. Because Daryl's just mischievous enough that there's 5% of me that thinks maybe he threw it out there. It would be
that'd be a bold move, Cotton.
It'd be a. I just rewatched that last week.
Good movie.
It would be a dumb thing for Daryl to do, and he's not a dumb person, given that he knows how much attention is on him, given his role, given the perceived pursuit of Harden, that it's his old team. Like, he has to hold himself to an even higher standard. So I don't think this is a time for him to get cute. So no, probably it was unintentional. Probably it was just the automated tweet. But even if he was doing it intentionally, where's the harm here? He did not say, I want James Harden on the Sixers. He did not say James Harden should be inducted into the Hall of Fame tomorrow. It was an automated tweet, or even if it wasn't, that simply praised Harden's assist record. He passed Calvin Murphy for the Rockets all time in assist, whatever it was. That's, to me, if you're punishing teams for that, it's like when they punished the Lakers and Magic Johnson, or was it Doc? No, similar thing. Magic had the audacity to say that Giannis was a really good player. And I think Doc had the audacity to say that Kawhi was a really good player. And they both got fined for those. And yes, those were teams that are possibly angling for those guys. But come on, if you can't have all-time greats like Magic Johnson or longstanding coaches who have coached and played against all kinds of Hall of Famers be able to assess people in real time the way that people like you and me, Chris, ask them to. We need Jerry West and Doc Rivers and Magic Johnson and others who have played the game at a high level to be able to talk to us about why this player of today is great and how he compares to your time or whatever, how he compares to you. You know, like I needed Magic to talk about the parallels with LeBron twice in the last 15 years. It was important that he could do that. If the league is fining people, fining NBA executives for praising other players because they think they're trying to angle for them, come on. And also, last thing, Harden's not a free agent. I understand like he has to be traded, or I understand that when it comes to tampering, even if it's a guy who's under contract, especially because he's under contract, the whole point is that you can't mess with him. But we know he wants to be traded. There's not a position of vulnerability for the Rockets here at all. He's the one who demanded out. Daryl Morey's not placing some thought in James Harden's head by praising him. I mean, give me a break. This is silly. They're doing it because it's low-hanging fruit. It's the one they can prove or think they can prove, and they can't get to all the really like serious, insidious tampering that's going on because it's too hard to prove.
Now they're doing it because of that, and they're doing it because it's Daryl Morey. There's no way you're going to convince me that if Neil Olshey accidentally tweeted that or Jeff Weltman accidentally tweeted that, that they would be subject to a $50,000 fine. I'm just not going to get on board with believing that. But let's talk about James Harden for a minute here. Two games into the regular season as we record this, and James Harden has looked like James Harden. At least his numbers have looked like James Harden. We saw in the opener 44 points against Portland. That was in a loss. 34 points against Denver. That was also in a loss. Against the Blazers, he went to the free throw line a Harden-esque 16 times in that game. Again, they lost both games, Howard, but that's not on James Harden. That's due to the fact that like the equipment manager is suiting up to give them enough guys to play these games while they're dealing with COVID-related issues. It has begged the question, with Harden playing like this and with reinforcements on the way in the form of Eric Gordon and John Wall and DeMarcus Cousins and others, is there any glimmer of hope here that the situation can be salvaged between Harden and the Rockets? I mean, I pick up the paper this week and I see Harden saying positive things about Stephen Silas, the new head coach there, who we had no relationship with before all this. Have we reached a point of no return, or is that door just a little bit open for Harden to finish out the season in Houston?
I think the door is still a little bit open for him to stay, and for a couple reasons. One, it's just not that easy to trade him where he wants to go, whether that's Brooklyn, Philly, Milwaukee, Miami, whatever teams he's added in the last 5 minutes. Like, it's hard to make trades in this league, period. It's hard to trade a top five player, as he has been every year for the last however many, and get fair value. And certainly, if you're Tillman Fertitta, who's only been in that ownership seat for a few years, if you're Rafael Stone, who's been in that GM seat for like 15 minutes, you don't want the hallmark move of your career, of your tenure, to be trading James Harden for a stack of role players and a couple of distant first-round picks. You're going to be judged by this. You're going to be remembered for this for a long time. You better get it right. So you don't let Harden dictate the timeline. And they're not. Like, they're doing this right, Chris. They're doing this right. And it's not easy. And it's been a really rough few weeks for them with quarantines and a postponed game and, you know, a slapdash roster and Harden in questionable-ish condition. Like, all of these things are tough for them. But to their credit, the team's playing hard. Harden is playing incredibly effectively despite being in, I think, less than prime condition at the moment. He'll work his way into it. And it buys them all time, Chris. If they're playing well, if they're being competitive, and Harden looks like Harden, then his market value is that much better. People can start to maybe forget a little bit about the film of him in various clubs and parties and things. And along the way, maybe Stephen Silas establishes enough of a rapport and credibility with him, and maybe those new additions start to you know, produce at a level where James Harden looks around and says, you know what, we're doing okay. And I know, look, like, this team is not contending for a title, Chris, right? You and I can look at this as glass half empty as we want to, and we're still not going to see a contender with a post-Achilles John Wall and a post-Achilles DeMarcus Cousins plus Christian Wood, Harden, and Gordon. Like, that's not a contender. But there's no guarantee that his next stop is a contender either. And the best thing about, you know, having James Harden is that he elevates your team to a certain minimum level. You're a 50-win team almost automatically just with him there. And wherever he goes, if that's the way he plays, that's what they're going to have to, you know, accommodate. And I don't think there's any guarantee that the next stop is going to be have a bigger upside than the roster he has around him right now. And they're probably not done making moves.
Yeah, I think the door is closed. I think it can be opened just a little if John Wall comes back from his Achilles injury, as well as we have seen Kevin Durant come back from his injury. Now, they're two different players. John Wall relies on speed far more than Kevin Durant does. That's something that could be taken away from him to a degree as a result of this injury. But if Wall comes back looking like 90-95% of the all-star player we saw a few years ago, maybe that's something that could entice James Harden to stay. I mean, look, John Wall is still very much in the prime of his career. He's 30 years old. If Harden looks at John Wall and says, look, this is a backcourt mate I can get used to, maybe he rethinks his position. Because Wall, as you know, is, you know, he's not Russell Westbrook. He is more of a pass-first point guard than he is a scoring point guard. So he's going to be looking to find opportunities for James Harden, and it's not going to be anywhere near as difficult, I think, to integrate as Russell Westbrook was. So that, to me, offers the only slight potential. If Harden sees Wall and sees this chemistry there and says, all right, look, this might be able to work for the next few years. Look, Stephen Silas really is the young coach that everybody has been talking about for the last couple of years. Maybe it can work in Houston, but that, to me, is the only chance they have of making it happen. And if I was going to handicap it at a percentage, I'd probably say 5-10% at most that Harden wants to stay.
Yeah, I'm not about to say it's likely, but I think it's possible. Here's the thing, Chris. Here's what we don't know. We don't know definitively, because James Harden has never actually addressed this publicly. We don't really know what's driving this, why right now, and what he's hoping to get out of it. It's easy to say, oh, he wants to win championships. Well, all right, a year ago, year and a half ago, I think we've talked about this. When I sat down with him, he talked about wanting to win championships, but wanting to do it in Houston and not wanting to link up with other stars and wanting to do it his way and chart his own course. Well, all that seems to be out the window. So if that changed, and that's fine. Like, he can change his mind. I'm not holding him to that and saying it's that he should be prisoner to that those statements at that time. Things change. But I don't know, Chris, exactly what he wants or what he's hoping to get right now and what he's willing to give up to do it. So because of that, it's hard to say, well, what would it take to keep him happy in Houston? And what if they swing some other trade tomorrow for some other additions? I'm not saying, you know, they're about to land, you know, Giannis or something, but, you know, I just think that there is enough ambiguity there that there's always the possibility. They get on a roll, as you point out, John Wall comes back and plays like the old John Wall or pretty close to it, and Harden's having fun and they're winning games. It can calm things down quite a bit.
Yeah, and look, I think that because they're not in a rush to make a deal, you give yourself a little bit of a runway to see what this team can look like. You can bring Wall in with Cousins and all those guys I mentioned, you know, go into February and see if you can create some kind of body of work that, you know, Harden may find appealing to play alongside with. I mean, that's really the only opportunity, but I still think the far most likely scenario is that before the trade deadline this year, we see James Harden move somewhere else. Let's talk about one of those teams he could be moved to, and that's the Brooklyn Nets. Their interest in James Harden has not really been much of a secret over the last few weeks. But they lost a key player in Spencer Dinwiddie. He suffered a partially torn ACL. No timeline on his return, but he will have surgery. And that suggests to me, Howard, we won't be seeing Spencer Dinwiddie for the rest of this season. Now, the Rockets may want to acquire him anyway, but that's a separate conversation. The question I have is we've seen the Nets, now they've had some bumps along the way. That loss to Charlotte, certainly a bump, but they've played well in games against Golden State and against Boston. How big a hit is the loss of Spencer Dinwiddie to Brooklyn's chances of being a championship team?
It's a hit, but I don't think it's a catastrophic hit. And the reason I can say that with more confidence today, as we record this on December 29th, than I could have said, say, 2 weeks ago, is that so far, Kevin Durant looks like 100% of Kevin Durant. Not, well, if he comes back at 95 or if he's 75 and he still be a top 10 player and all these weird calculations we're making and guesses. No, he looks like 100% of Kevin Durant. Now, it's a long way to go, and he's already taken a day off for rest purposes and just preservation purposes. And he's got to last through the season and still be playing at this level all the way through. But if Kevin Durant is 100% of Durant as he looks to be, and Kyrie is playing out of his mind as he is, and those guys are looking good together as they are, and Caris LeVert is playing at an incredibly high level, and they've still got the rest of that depth, like, I think they're okay. Were they that much better off having Spencer Dinwiddie there as their starting two next to Kyrie and as a secondary playmaker and as a guy who could, if you needed him to, anchor the second unit? That's LeVert's job at the moment. But Spencer Dinwiddie can fill a lot of roles, and he can do a lot of things for a team. And he's just also just a steadying presence. He's a really smart dude. He's a great locker room presence. And he's also representative of where that team has been and what they built themselves into. You know, he's a survivor who cast aside by a couple of teams and built himself into this really nice player. And I think that, you know, that kind of character matters just in terms of the way that a team functions together. So it hurts them, hurts their playmaking, hurts their scoring, hurts their depth. But I think there's enough there between LeVert and Joe Harris and, you know, even a guy like Landry Shamet. I know, like, it's been up and down for him his first couple of years in the league, but he's a good player. He can shoot. He can handle the ball some. They've got enough there. And when you look at who they're up against in the East, everybody's got their flaws, and no other team can boast starting off with a top two of Durant and Kyrie. So the margin for error got lower, but they're still in great shape to want to contend.
Yeah, I think they went from a team that had incredible depth to a team that just has really good depth. And that's not something that's going to prevent you from winning a championship. I do wonder who becomes kind of the secondary playmaker on that team. If you look down their depth chart, they've got combo guards. I mean, LeVert can handle the ball. Shamet, as you mentioned, can handle the ball. Tyler Johnson is there, though I can't imagine them wanting to rely on him for substantial minutes, but he can play the point guard position. They don't really have, you know, kind of that secondary playmaker, and that's going to maybe make Steve Nash want to reshuffle the deck a little bit to change things up. But they've got plenty of talent. I mean, say you move LeVert into that starting lineup, you lose some firepower with your second unit. But we know nowadays, Howard, second units aren't the same. It's not like they're – it's not hockey lines here. Like, you're going to see eventually minutes being staggered between Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, so one of them is on the floor at all times. Teams do that all the time in the NBA. So it's a blow, but not a catastrophic one, especially if they can find someone from that mix of players that we mentioned, whether it's, you know, Shamet or Torian Prince, another candidate to play some more minutes. I mentioned Tyler Johnson. Somebody probably has to step up and play a more significant role, but you're talking about eighth or ninth man on a team that's headlined by two all-NBA talents in Durant and Kyrie.
Yeah, I think there's enough bodies there and enough versatility. They can shuffle things around a little bit. It takes away some flexibility, and I like LeVert anchoring the second unit, and you're right. You don't have to. It's not a strict line change. So LeVert can move into the starting lineup, play alongside Kyrie in Dinwiddie's spot, and you can still stagger the rotation and the minutes in a way where LeVert still anchors the second unit at times, or Kyrie does with some of the second unit guys, or Durant does, whatever. Like, between those three guys, if those are your three pillars now, and they're all guys who can do a lot with the ball in their hands, you'll find a way to cobble together your 48 minutes where at least one of those guys is always on the court. Like, this is not rocket science. They'll be fine. Having a fourth guy who could have the ball in his hands and both create and score in Dinwiddie was a bit of a luxury. I think, you know, the other piece of this, though, and you mentioned it as we, you know, jumped into this topic, is well, what does that do for their trade possibilities? Because, you know, he would have been part, Dinwiddie, of any package for Harden, assuming that they were going to be aggressive there. And now if you're the Rockets, well, what are you getting out of that? He's, you know, a pending free agent, and it doesn't really make much sense. And Harden aside, if the Nets needed to make any midseason moves, Dinwiddie was a guy who would be, you know, very marketable. Like, a lot of teams would covet him, a lot of playoff teams. He would have been great. We've talked about this, but maybe you and I talked about this. I talked about it with someone. Dinwiddie would have been perfect for the Clippers, who really could use an upgrade at the point. Somebody steadier there who can do more with the ball in his hands, and who's a great veteran presence. There are things out there. I don't know if they would have pursued them, but, you know, anything involving Dinwiddie now to upgrade somewhere else or make a move, that's kind of off the table now.
Yeah, I guess a team that looked at Dinwiddie as someone they wanted to be in business with beyond one season could certainly still acquire him. I mean, he's got a player option next year for $12 million, unless, even with the injury, I can't see him exercising that option. There's too much money to be made on a long-term contract. And I could still see a team out there that, maybe not a contender like the Clippers, who are looking at things more of in a win-now type of lens, but... No, if you're a team like Houston, you think that John Wall and Dinwiddie would be, you know, a good pairing in that backcourt together, you could still be interested and want to be in business with Spencer Dinwiddie over the long term. So we'll see. It does hurt them, though, significantly. It does hurt them in the short term as far as a guy that was really effective. It would be really effective for them as a secondary ball handler, I think, with that group. All right, let's talk a little bit about the Clippers here. Actually, let's jump to them real quick. The Clippers look good in the early part, in the first couple of games of this season, and then they play the Dallas Mavericks. And I don't know about you, Howard, but on social media, I'm looking at these tweets where it's like, wait, the score is what? And now the score is what? 77-27 at halftime. To the Nets, or to the Clippers' credit, they played them to a standstill the rest of the way, only lost by 50, but falling behind by 50 at halftime is certainly noticeable, even in the early stages of what's undoubtedly going to be a wacky season. Should we read anything into this? Like, is this a big warning sign that the Clippers got smacked in one of the early games of the season, in a game they played without their star player in Kawhi Leonard? I mean, how serious should we take the Clippers getting tattooed by the Dallas Mavericks?
So I think we have to look at it this way. Let's sub in another team that has high expectations. If the Boston Celtics had lost by 50 in game three or whatever of the season, if the Sixers had lost by 50 in game three of the season, if the Nuggets had lost by 50 in game three of the season, maybe I would look at it and say, wow, that's crazy. I can't believe it just happened. But you know what? Short turnaround from last season. It's a weird year. It's a weird season. They were missing a player, in the Clippers' case, Kawhi, missing an important player. Maybe it was Jokic if it was Denver in this example. And I would say early season aberration, they'll be fine. I don't like overreacting to things in the first week of the season. But it's the Clippers. It's not one of those other teams. And we already know there's frailties with this team because we all saw it in the bubble, and they've openly talked about it. This is a team that has at various times seemed to lack the right chemistry. I think they've been open about that. I think lacks some leadership. I think they've at least hinted about that. And lacks some playmaking. And like those three things, Chris, were all undermining factors for them and why they flamed out in the second round instead of being the championship contenders that a lot of us thought they were going to be last season. And so given all that, losing by 50 to a Dallas team that's good, not great. It's not super team. It's not the, you know, it's not the Miami Heat of Dwayne Wade and LeBron James and Chris Bosh. It's not the Warriors super team with Durant and Curry. Like it's Luka and a bunch of guys. Like, you lost by 50 to it. Just a solid team like that. I just can't get it out of my head. So I looked this up, Chris. There are only seven other teams that lost by 50 or more in a regular season game in the last 10 years. This is since 2010, according to Basketball Reference. And this is not a group you want to be part of. It's the 2011 Cavaliers post LeBron, who lost by more than 50 to the Lakers. They finished with 19 wins. two teams, two Philly process era teams in 2014 and 2015 lost by 50 plus. Those teams finished with 18 wins and 10 wins. There's a Grizzlies team in 2015 that loses to the Warriors. That was the 73-win Warrior team, by the way. They lose by 50 to them. That Grizzlies team finished 42 and 40. So modest winning record. They lost in the first round. Another Memphis team in 2018, they went 22 and 60 after having a 50-point loss. A Bulls team in 2018 got spanked by Boston by 50 plus. They went 22 and 60. The only team in the last 10 years that had suffered a 50-point loss in the regular season and actually had a good record was the Utah Jazz in 2018. They lose to Dallas by 50 plus. They finished 50 and 32, so they were still a good team. They lost in the first round in five games to the Rockets. So what I'm saying is, if you lose by 50 plus in a regular season game, you're probably no better than a first round and out team. And more, you know, more to the point, most of these teams were just terrible, terrible teams. Now, Kawhi didn't play, all that. That's fine. I just think that it's a warning sign. And if they flame out again next spring, we will look back at this loss and say it did mean something. And if they somehow get to the conference finals or even the finals, we'll say, okay, it was the aberration that we thought it was. But as of right now, I'm having a hard time just waving it away as an aberration.
Yeah, to not come with any kind of efforts or any kind of energy or focus against, to your point, a team that's good but certainly not great is just embarrassing. And I don't think you can just sweep it under the rug as, it's one game in a long, weird season. Because you're right, it is the Clippers. And they have had issues of leadership and, you know, showing up, quite frankly. I mean, blowing a 3-1 lead in the postseason last year will hang around their neck for a long time. And I start to think, and I was hearing this from scouts during the preseason and kind of the whole buildup to the start of the regular season, that the Clippers, whatever you think of kind of the Etch-a-Sketch game they played with their roster, replacing Montrezl Harrell with Serge Ibaka and some of the moves they made on the fringes, they didn't add anything in terms of real leadership. And that continues to be a void on this Clippers team. I mean, Kawhi Leonard's got two championships. He has not been a leader on any one of those two teams. In San Antonio, that was a team during its championship year that was led in the locker room by Tim Duncan and had Manu Ginobili and Tony Parker, among others. In Toronto, the infrastructure there was already in place. Yes, what Kawhi did on the court was indispensable. They don't win without Kawhi Leonard. But Kyle Lowry was the leader of that team. They had strong presences, whether it was the form of Fred VanVleet and even Ibaka in that mix. Marc Gasol was there. That was a team that had been together for a long time, that knew each other really well. Kawhi just kind of enhanced that group. So he's never had to be the face of the franchise, really. He's never had to be that guy. And the same thing, to a degree, can be said with Paul George. When Paul George was having success in Indiana, David West was the leader of that team. David West was the heart and soul of that team. He has a cup of coffee with Oklahoma City, and, well, they didn't do anything, so you don't really have to, you know, compliment them for any kind of leadership there. So, you know, Paul George comes to L.A., and he's kind of got the same baggage where he's a really good player, maybe even a great player, but not someone that has established himself as a leader. And I'm sorry, you can't win without that. You can't win without leadership at the highest level in your locker room. The Lakers, they've got it. LeBron is a leader, maybe the best leader in the entire NBA. Frankly, I think the Nets have, because I think Kevin Durant is a pretty strong leader with that group. A handful of other teams out there we can point to that have leadership in their locker room. Right now, the Clippers don't have it. So, yeah, they'll probably go on like a 5-game winning streak in the next few weeks, and the people look back and go, oh, that was funny, right? But no, you're right. If they go down early in the playoffs, we'll remember this as kind of a foreshadowing event for what happened to the Clippers down the line.
And the thing is, Chris, like, I can think of like finals. I never remember which finals it is. There was the one finals, you know, Miami and San Antonio had back-to-back years, so I never remember which year it was. But there was one of those finals in particular where we went three or four straight games where one team or the other won by like 20, 25 points. And every time you see one of those games, you think, this thing's over. They've figured them out. They've got their number. They're going to win the next three in a row, and it's over, whatever, wherever the series was at that time. And instead, it kept flipping back and forth. We have these like 45-point swings between games. The NBA is weird like that sometimes. It's not always, you know, one score, one result, one day is never that definitive. And teams will sometimes stumble in the course of a regular season, just had a bad day. Guys woke up on the wrong side of the bed. Whatever happened, like out too late, something. And you lose by 25 to a team you shouldn't have lost to, or by 30. But you don't lose by 50. You don't fall behind by 50 by halftime and show no fight along the way. Like, that's the thing. It's not just that they got beat badly by a good team. It's the scale of it. It's just the monstrosity of that score. And it's like, no, that's the signal of something else. I don't know exactly what, probably some combination of things we've been talking about, but it makes me wonder, like, does this, you know, they got Paul George and they got Kawhi Leonard, and they had a really good core group that they added them to a year and a half ago. But knowing what we know now, and you know, they've made some minor changes along the way. Montrezl Harrell's out, Ibaka's in. Like, isn't there another move to make here still, Chris? What should this front office be doing between now and the trade deadline? I feel like a move for whether it's a point guard or whether it's just another leadership type, a steady veteran who's been around, who can be that voice that Paul George and Kawhi Leonard aren't. I just feel like they need some other infusion there. I know Ibaka is you know, can address that to a some extent, but I feel like there's maybe one more move out there. I mean, I've said it before. I'd love to see them get Kyle Lowry. I don't know how they could even pull it off. I don't know if Lowry will even be available. I think there's a case that he should be. But I do think, like, the Clippers, there's a risk here in leaving this alone.
Yeah. I agree. I don't know what that move is. I don't know what assets they have to go and get him without breaking up the core of that team. But, I mean, maybe it's in the buyout market, whenever that is. So, I don't know. But you might be right. They could be one move away from really being a championship contender. All right, let's talk about a team that is not a championship contender, but one that you were kind of high on coming into this season there, Howard. That is the Washington Wizards. Opened the season 0-3, two losses to the Orlando Magic. In all three of their games, they have blown fourth quarter leads, giving up an eye-popping amount of points in those fourth quarters. What do we make of the Wizards? I mean, what's their level of panic on what we're seeing in Washington?
I think they got to be at least a little concerned, Chris, just because this is a team that has been on the clock for a while with Bradley Beal, you know, and they settled in on that extension a year plus ago, short-term extension, bought them a little time, long, you know, more security for Bradley Beal, more time for the new front office with Tommy Shepard at the head of it to try to get things right and figure out a path forward. And, you know, look, John Wall was like going to be with the most untradeable contract in the history of untradeable contracts. And they managed to move him for an upgrade in Russell Westbrook, and they've made some decent moves along the way. Like, I like the pick of Abdia as in the draft. Hachimura had a good rookie season. He's out right now. So they're making, you know, solid moves along the way. But if Bradley Beal, who's in his prime and wants to be assured that they're on the right path, and he's part of this too, so I don't mean to leave him out of this. He's not some innocent bystander. But if they're not taking that leap forward and contending for one of those last playoff spots in the East, if Russell Westbrook and Beal aren't the answer to all the problems, then where are you? And how much longer is it before Beal finally breaks from his stance of I'll never ask for a trade? Like, at some point, I feel like that's inevitable. And I've brought that up many times over the last year or so. I'm not wishing for it. I just think that in today's environment where stars are very cognizant of how they're perceived, and in his case, not getting All-Star and All-NBA recognition, knowing you need to win, being tired of just not winning, not even being in the playoffs, being irrelevant in the spring when you're one of the best players in the league, and I think Beal is, that's tough. So I'm not going to overreact 0-3, And, you know, Beal and Westbrook have just gotten together and they do need Hachimura back in the lineup and healthy. And they are relying on some young players, but you know, it's not the start you wanted, especially after dropping whatever $70 million on Bertans to bring him back and then bringing in Westbrook. Like, yeah, this franchise was expecting a definite step forward and we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. And I think that, look, you have to look at the Wizards through the lens of expectations, for lack of a better phrase. Like, you have to say, look, we're not expecting them to be a top four team in the Eastern Conference, but we are expecting them to be a solid 6-7-8 playoff team in the conference. And I think that's still very much something they can bounce back and recover from. They've got the Bulls on one of those quirky back-to-backs the NBA's put out to minimize travel. The Bulls, at least early on, look like kind of a cure-all to everybody with, you know, the losses they've had and how they've lost some of their games. Plus, you look at what the Wizards have dealt with their roster early on. I mean, Westbrook didn't play on Sunday. Hachimura being out. Davis Bertans on something of a minutes restriction right now. As they get healthier and more cohesive, I think they will be a better team. But you're right. This all, again, to use the lens sort of way of looking at it, it all needs to be looked through the lens of Bradley Beal. Like, it's at some point, you do have to say, all right, are we sure this guy is going to want to be here long term? Because if we're not sure of it, we've got to cut bait. We have got to move along and acquire as many assets as possible to rebuild this team without him. That's got to be an ongoing conversation that Tommy Shepard has with Beal, with his agent, with everybody around him, because you have to make sure that either he wants to be there long term, or if he doesn't, you get a massive package for a star that would be incredibly coveted if he hit the trade market.
Yeah. And, you know, look, I don't know that there are that many sweetheart deals out there to get along the lines of what the Thunder got for Paul George with all those picks, or what the Pelicans got for Anthony Davis with all those picks, plus the players, you know, guys like Ingram and Ball. Like, I don't know how many more of those are out there. But you have the Harden trade kind of waiting to happen. At some point, the market will figure it out. The team will find the right package or involve multiple teams, and the Rockets will get the payoff that they need to depart with Harden. And then it's going to be a little depleted again, right? Like, where do the Wizards go to trade Beal then if he's the next one up? And, you know, look, like, there's always assets out there. There's always a team to find. But I just think that, yeah, you need to be ahead of the game on that. And we're putting the cart before the horse here. We're getting ahead of ourselves. Like, it's not time to start talking about a Bradley Beal trade. And so, you know, apologies, Wizards fans, for hitting that panic button on December 29th. But it's out there. And it's like you and I have both said, that is the prism through which you see this. And for some teams, if you start slow, the urgency is, well, the owner is getting antsy, or the GM is getting antsy with the coach, or, you know, people's jobs are at stake. And I'm not saying that that's not possibly the case here too. Like, Tommy Shepard could be on the clock. Scott Brooks, I think, is in the last year of his deal. There's always those consequences.
Scott Brooks is already ranked. He's already ranked on those odds makers for his coach to be fired, already on the chopping block.
So there's always those consequences too for a bad start or for not meeting, you know, a raised expectation bar. But the bigger one is still Beal. The bigger one is, does Beal believe in this franchise? Because if you lose him, you're starting over, even with Westbrook. I mean, Westbrook will give you a certain floor, but that's the consequences for not pushing this thing forward quickly enough now, is that you're going to lose the faith of your franchise star, and then he's going to want to leave. And you can get a ton for him, I think. Like, I think they could get a phenomenal deal that would set them up really nicely for a great rebuild, but still a rebuild.
I think the Nets would throw probably that package that they were throwing at Houston for James Harden. I think that sort of Dinwiddie, you know, LeVert, Allen picks package would be available for Bradley Beal, who might be a better fit in Brooklyn than James Harden would be. I mean, Harden, not to swing us back to the previous conversation, but Harden, like, to me, that always represented a risk, you know, putting a high usage rate player in with two other high usage rate players. Like, that to me seemed more risky than Bradley Beal, who, you know, while he needs his shots, is a shooter and someone I think would complement Irving and Durant much better than Harden would.
Yeah, and I could listen, if we want to start, you know, playing the where would Bradley Beal thrive game, you and I could identify a bunch of teams he would be great with. I mean, the Pelicans still have assets to move. In fact, they've got all those Laker picks they could use. How great would he look next to Brandon Ingram and Zion Williamson? You could, you know, Denver was always a team I've had an eye on because of their depth and their ability to make a multiplayer deal. How great would he be next to Jamal Murray and Jokic and an emerging Michael Porter Jr.? You know, I'm sure we could find many more. Now, are these places he'd want to go, places that he would resign? That's a different question. You know, could Miami make a pitch for him? You know, so, you know, I don't know if Milwaukee has anything left to trade, but he'd look.
No, they do not.
They do not. But he would look phenomenal next to Giannis. There's, you know, there are possibilities out there if and when they reach that point. Obviously, they're hoping to avoid reaching that point. And again, it's early. But I do think that it's not fair to overreact at 0-3. It's fair to react. And 0-3 is a bad start for a team that has expectations that really needs to start showing progress soon.
And this time next week, we'll be talking about the Wizards making a comeback. Are they a top four team in the Eastern Conference? That's how weird this season is going to be. Until next week, Howard, always good to talk to you, man.
Always a pleasure, my friend.